We hope you enjoy this episode of the Modern Divorce Podcast. But first, an important message for our listeners.
Embarking on a new chapter? Zach Knutzman of the Darwin Wall team at Realty One Group is your go-to real estate expert in Arizona, specializing in guiding couples and families through their real estate needs while experiencing a divorce. Modern Law's trusted partner, Zach, brings expertise, confidence, and compassion to your real estate journey. Let him help you navigate this challenging time. Zach Knutzman, your modern solution in real estate. Visit ZachSellsAZ.com to get started. Mark, how are you?
I'm great. Can you hear me okay?
Thank you for being here.
You're welcome. I'm sorry. I'm a few minutes late here. I just got out of a meeting a minute ago, so.
It's totally okay. I appreciate your time being here. And we already did a little bit of an intro for you.
Perfect.
So you finished law school in 2005. That's right when I did. So we've been doing this a long time.
Yes.
And I see that you were a prosecutor for Maricopa County and Pinal County.
Yeah, absolutely. Yes.
So how long have you been?
About 12 years.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
And how long have you been in private practice?
I've been in private practice since 2017. So 4 years.
Nice.
Excuse me, 7 years. I don't know why I said 4 years. 2024. Yeah, 7 years.
Well, thank you so much for making the time. Where do you live in the Valley?
So currently I live in the West Valley previously, and I raised my family in the East Valley, actually in Gilbert.
Awesome.
Yeah. So I'm very familiar.
Awesome. And have you been following the Gilbert Goons saga at all?
So not to fanboy too much, but yes, via you a lot.
Oh, good.
On TikTok.
We love TikTok, don't we? We love TikTok.
Yeah.
For putting in front of us what we want to hear about. Yes. Well, and so as you know, then yesterday was kind of a major break in the case, and there have now been 6 arrests, right, and the charges are pretty severe. And we, the public, have lots and lots of questions about, right, what all of this means.
Right. It is an interesting day today. Yeah. When I woke up this morning and saw the news, I was like, oh, wow, finally something. Finally, right?
Okay, so it's really interesting to hear you, a professional, say finally.
Right.
Because we, the public, have felt a little gaslit.
Right.
At the Maricopa County attorney telling us that we have been impatient, but you also think finally. So tell me a little bit about that.
So, yeah, it's interesting, again, that it's taken, March 7th now? And so it's just been this long. Again, as you mentioned before, I was a prosecutor for 12 years in a couple different jurisdictions, 8 years at Maricopa County. So I've seen it from that side. I know how quickly they can investigate cases, how quickly they can do evidence and do things. And it's just shocking it's taken this long to get to the point of, an actual indictment and charges. That's especially on a very serious, serious case with a lot of publicity behind it. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, yeah. And it does seem like they've put a lot of resources on it and they've taken it seriously, and they know how much the public is taking it seriously. And
sure,
it did feel like it took a long time, but here we are. And now so far, 6 people have been charged, and they've all been charged with felony murder.
Yes.
And kidnapping.
Yes.
Is the felony the kidnapping?
So to be fair, and as disclosure, I haven't actually looked at the indictment yet. I haven't seen the actual indictment, but felony murder is a law in Arizona that if someone's committing there's some specific set of felonies that are allowed for that. Kidnapping is one of them. If in the course of, or in the furtherance of doing said felony, kidnapping, presumably in this case, somebody dies, one could be charged with felony murder, which is a first degree murder charge, which is the highest, most serious charge you can get. So presumably that may be the charge that's the underlying felony for felony murder. Again, I'm not 100% sure because I haven't seen the actual indictment, but yeah.
Okay. So someone else was charged with aggravated robbery in let me just make sure to get that up and be accurate. But I believe there are also aggravated robbery charges. Could it be any felony that leads to felony murder?
It's not. So it can't just be any type of felony. There's, you know, lots and lots and lots of crimes that are on the books. It's not just any felony. It's very, very specific. And it has to be some of the more serious types of felonies that we're talking about. The idea behind that felony murder law is if you're out committing one of these very serious crimes, be aware, because if something happens, somebody dies, you're getting charged with something serious. So it can't be a less serious type of felony, you know, as a simple, let's say, drug possession or something like that. That's not one of those crimes, but something like kidnapping is, you know, an armed robbery. Those types of offenses that are a little bit more serious are on the list of crimes that are allowed for sure.
So the first person here that they've got listed is William Owen Hine, and his charges are one count of first degree murder and in the alternative second degree, both class one felonies, and then one count of kidnapping, a class two felony. So can you explain that? If the felony murder is for the kidnapping, then would that be two separate counts?
Yeah, it's prosecutors can choose how they decide or elect to charge someone with any particular offense that may have occurred. In this case, it appears the Maricopa County Attorney's Office have charged a count in the alternative, which is rare. It's legal, but it's rare. And so essentially what they'd be presenting to the jury at trial is, we believe this murder happened by two different ways. One way is it's second degree murder. And the other way we believe it happened is there was this felony being committed. And in the course of that felony, this individual Preston Lord Bean passed away, and this person's responsible for it. So that someone can commit murder by multiple different ways under multiple different theories under the law is what it is. And so, and then separate and apart from that is just a kidnapping. So an individual can be convicted of both the felony murder and also the separate underlying felony. And those are separate charges, separate convictions that carry with them separate sentences.
Wow.
Yeah.
And is it true that if someone is convicted of first degree murder, the minimum sentence is life in prison?
That is true. That is what the law is in Arizona. It's a life imprisonment. And yeah, that's what it is. So there's also the possibility, if the prosecutor elected, and again, we don't know that yet, they could pursue the ultimate penalty, which is allowed under this in Arizona, which is the death penalty. That decision, I don't know if that's been made yet by Rachel Mitchell or not in her office. They have a time period after which they charge someone to make that determination if they're seeking that type of penalty or not. In my experience, usually under first degree felony murder, they usually do not seek that type of penalty. And that's usually reserved for a more of a premeditated type of murder situation. But it is a possible penalty. But nevertheless, the minimum is life imprisonment. Yes.
Okay. And if they were convicted of more than one crime, it would just get tacked on, like life in prison plus?
Yes. Yes. As crazy as that sounds, yeah, individuals can get a life sentence for felony murder and then have other charges as well and get convicted for those and get life imprisonment. And then also on top of that, another 10 and a half years, another 21 years. And the judge could choose also to run that second count concurrent, meaning at the same time as a life sentence, or consecutive, which is, I guess, an academic discussion. But I don't know how you get consecutive to serving a life sentence, but that means one sentence after the other. But yeah, those can be stacked on top of each other.
Many people are very, very confused about the kidnapping charges because the allegation is that, you know, he was beaten and murdered in a fight.
Yeah.
How do we get to kidnapping?
That is a great question. Love that question. So as a prosecutor years ago, in Phoenix, there was a lot of news. This is 2008 and 9, around that time, 2010. A lot of news about kidnappings going on, and kidnapping, and most of us think of someone's grabbing a kid or grabbing a person and throwing them in the trunk of a car and driving off. It's really not that complicated. It's actually much more simple than that. Kidnapping is someone knowingly restrains another person. And the word restrains doesn't necessarily mean, you know, you're tying them up, duct taping them, or anything else. Restrain under the law in Arizona simply means restricting someone's movement. So get in the corner, don't move, and I hold a gun at you and tell you not to move, I'm restraining you. So kidnapping is restraining somebody with the intent to do something else. That's what makes it kidnapping. A restraint is an unlawful imprisonment. A restraint with some other further intention is a kidnapping. And under the law in Arizona, there's several different ways you can commit a kidnapping. So restraining with the intent to hold someone for ransom, hold them as a hostage or something like that. Another way you could do that is you're holding them with the intent to inflict death, physical injury, a sexual offense, or somehow aid in the commission of some other crime that's going on. Again, I haven't seen the indictment, but that potentially could be one of the theories here, is that they're restraining with the intent to inflict physical injury. So again, I don't know all the facts and circumstances, but if you are restraining someone's movement with the intention of hurting them or causing them harm or killing them, that could be it. One of the other ways you could do it is if you're restraining them with the intent to place the victim in reasonable apprehension of imminent physical injury. So if you're restraining them with the intention of causing them future harm or something like that. So you can see these theories under the law, you can get a little bit loose with it and how you can charge someone with kidnapping when they're not tying someone up or moving them from one spot to another spot or driving them from this state to that state. It doesn't require any of that. It's actually very, very broad and can come up in a lot of different scenarios.
So does that mean if somebody was holding him, his arms or his body, while someone else was hitting him, could that be the kidnapping?
Absolutely, it could be, right? So someone is holding someone's arms down or pinning them down on the ground while someone else is assaulting that individual. If they are restraining them with the intent to assault them, with the intent to cause them physical injury, with the intent to do something else, that's where you get that kidnapping. That absolutely could be the scenario.
You mentioned the death penalty. Some of these are minors. If I understand correctly, they can't be given the death penalty. Is that right?
That is right. Under the law in the United States, juveniles or minors, people under the age of 18 cannot receive the death penalty.
But anybody over 18 could.
They could. Yeah. If the jury makes the proper findings of that, they could sentence somebody to death. Yes.
One of the individuals who was arrested today, the accusation is that he filmed the attack.
Okay.
And then left the scene and colluded to come up with a story and or destroy evidence.
Okay.
And he is also being charged with felony murder and kidnapping.
Interesting. Okay.
Can you explain this? So how does this like group charging work? If let's say one person held him doing the kidnapping, one person hit him doing the assault, like how does the group charging work?
That is a great question. So this comes up in Arizona. It's called accomplice liability. Like you said, maybe one person's actually doing the hitting, one's holding down, one's filming, maybe one's driving them away from where the crime happened, right? But these are what we call accomplices. And under Arizona law, an accomplice is responsible for the conduct and the foreseeable conduct and what they intend to assist in. So, you know, your classic example is the bank robbery, right? The one that goes in to rob the bank, and then the getaway driver didn't actually have the gun or didn't rob the bank, but they were part of that, they get charged with the exact same crime because they're assisting in committing that crime. They assist in committing it, getting someone there, getting them the tools to commit the crime, assisting on scene, or assisting them in getting away from the crime, or helping it after the fact. So accomplice liability comes in many ways, but it applies the same. It's not a lesser charge. It's not a lesser degree. It's the same charge, but as an accomplice, you assisted somebody or were an accomplice to somebody. So yeah.
Is this normal? Like, how often does this really happen? Because it feels weird a little bit to charge someone with first degree murder who took the video. It feels that there should be maybe less culpability, but maybe less. So yeah. How often does this happen?
Yeah, that is it's a unique circumstance. Again, I don't have, as I speak, I qualify everything I'm saying because I don't have all the police reports. I haven't seen all the evidence, but based on what we know publicly at this point, it does seem a little bit odd that a person who is filming, not participating in some way, and maybe afterwards is helping with the cover-up story, that does seem a little bit odd to charge them with the same level as maybe the person that is holding them down and the person that's doing the actual beating that results in Preston's death, the actual murder. That is odd. It is an odd circumstance to have that. Now, again, I don't know all the circumstances. I don't know if this is all part of the same plan. So when I mentioned before about accomplice liability, it's very broad. The statutes are very broad and the prosecutor can choose when to invoke that or not. So accomplice liability is someone that solicits or commands another person to commit an offense. So I don't know if the individual, for example, that's filming said, "Hey, you guys go do this and I'll film it." They're soliciting or commanding another person to do it. That's an accomplice. And so again, you get that same level of offense. Did they aid, they counsel, agree to aid or attempt to aid another person in planning or committing it, provide a means or opportunity for them? So it's very broad. So again, without knowing a little bit more information, whether or not that's an appropriate charge or not, I don't know, but it is odd if it's just someone who happens to be there, happens to film it, knows the suspects or the defendants in this case who are involved and even talks to them after. That's not enough in and of itself. There has to be these elements of assistance or commanding or aiding, you know, those types of things are what's required, if that makes sense under the law.
Got it. So that's where we would see a defense attorney come in and plead not guilty and say, we don't think that our client did this. Participated in or furthered and the murder.
Exactly. That's exactly it. You know, the type of defense you have under the law is what we call, you know, presence. I was merely present when the crime happened, but I didn't participate in any way, shape, or form. Because I was there filming a fight doesn't ergo make me guilty of what happens in that fight or the consequences of that fight. You know, I understand it's a teenagers, a bunch of them, at a party. I have teenage children myself, so, you know, not that it's a proud moment, but, you know, kids film everything these days all the time. And so simply filming because a fight, I might call it a fight, it ultimately ends up being a murder happens. That in and of itself isn't a crime. There must be something else there to latch on to. We're going to hold you to the same level of culpability as the person actually killing Preston.
In the civil lawsuit that has been filed, one of the allegations is that there is a civil conspiracy to commit these assaults. Part of that civil conspiracy includes videoing it and then posting it and humiliating the victim.
Yes.
So is that, if that's a pattern, if that's part of the conspiracy, how does the civil conspiracy theory translate to the criminal context?
That's a great question. I see what I see kind of in the news as I read little snippets and different things of what I've seen all over the recent interview of, and I can't remember her name, the woman
Ashley Reynolds.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Who recently came forward and said, you know, I quickly became involved unknowingly and whatever else. Mm-hmm. You know, just listening to different things, it appears that these groups of kids were doing this. And I think I read somewhere or heard somewhere this was somehow some kind of initiation or something else that, you know, that they were going to film and they were going to beat on someone and film it. And then, you know, as kids would do, post it everywhere because there's no point in filming it unless you're going to share it with other people. Otherwise, what's the point of filming something, right? So that they do that. And because of that, it's what brings, quote, in their minds, these kids' minds, value to the beating is the praise that's gained from it, the, quote, respect that's gained by the gang or the group of individuals from what occurred. And so it all becomes wrapped up in that the filming does become part of, you know, the beating, because one without the other, you know, both parts are needed in order to have this whole thing kind of come together in this perfect tragic storm for Preston.
So if one of the other issues that's outstanding is whether or not there will be gang enhancements and whether or not the Gilbert Goons will be classified as a street gang. And the police chief of Gilbert yesterday said that that is an ongoing investigation and no decision has been made. But if indeed it is a street gang and this is part of what this gang does, would that impact the felony murder charges?
Phrase that one more time because I didn't quite understand that.
Yeah. So one of the things they're looking at is whether or not they can classify the Gilbert Goons as a street gang.
Right, right.
And if they are, then apparently there will be increased sentencing, mm-hmm. which again doesn't seem to be all that relevant when you're looking at life in prison. But if they can prove, yes, this is a gang and part of their gang activity was going around beating people up and filming it, does that increase the culpability of the filmer?
It does. And sorry, one of the parts you said is like, why charge gang mm-hmm. charges or something if you have the ultimate charge mm-hmm. of murder? Again, hearkening back to experience, prosecutors may charge certain things because it allows them to get into other evidence that they wouldn't be able to get into otherwise, right? If they've only charged a murder that happened on that day, then they can talk about evidence and things that occurred that day, that evening, and what happened. But if the prosecutor wants to get into the bigger picture of, look, this person filming is actually part of this bigger thing going on as part of this gang, well, then they have to charge a gang charge so that they're allowed to talk about the bigger picture of how this fits into something much, much larger. So that's why you would add a charge like that. It allows the prosecutor to get into evidence and paint a bigger, broader picture for the jury of what totally is going on and how this filmer video, this person taking video, is part of this gang, if that's what they're alleging, and why that's just an important element as the actual beating and why that person should be held to the same level of culpability and how that person becomes an accomplice. Again, as I read to you about soliciting, aiding, counseling the other individual, you know, that's the accomplice statute is very, very broad. And so in order for the prosecutor to get to something like that, they probably have to allege this type of gang thing and they'd have to get into this bigger picture thing. Otherwise, it doesn't make any sense. Just on its face, it's odd. And at the end of the day, when you're talking about to a jury and presenting a case and evidence, most jurors have pretty good common sense. Like, does this make sense to me or does it not make sense to me? Right. And so the prosecutor needs to be able to get into a lot more evidence than just what happened that night.
Okay. So a couple of questions from that. Right now, there are no charges for gang charges. Will the charges change? Could the charges be changed? Or are the prosecutors stuck with the charges that they initially make?
Great question. They can change. The charges can change at any time. So the charges that we have now is because the prosecutor presented via the investigator their investigation to a grand jury who listened, who decided by probable cause there's probably a crime that happened and these are probably the individuals that did it. If at some point the prosecutor finds more evidence or wants to seek more charges, they can go back to the grand jury and present that again and get additional charges or a new indictment. They can add charges to that, but via that same process, they would do that. And so it can change. It happens often. I have many clients whose charges change during the course of the representation, depending on the evidence. Charges can be added. Charges can be taken away. It's all part of the process of going through the court system.
Okay. One of the questions that many people have asked is, had they, any of these boys or young men come forward earlier, would they be facing lesser charges?
Interesting. I don't know the answer to that question. I mean, it's a hypothetical that we don't really know. When you're, I guess your listeners or you're asking if they had came forward, is that under the scenario of like, if they had cooperated with police sooner, is that what that is suggesting maybe?
They're wondering, yeah, what people are asking is if somebody had come and turned themselves in and said, hey, I want to cooperate, I was part of this, could they then have negotiated a manslaughter plea and been looking at many fewer years? That's the question.
Yeah, no, that's what I thought you were asking. I was just making sure. Usually what we end up seeing is if someone were to come forward early on and cooperate and with police and provide names or information or evidence that would lead to other arrests and other individuals, and that individual would likely be asked to testify in a future trial against those other people, those individuals usually get charged with honestly the same thing. The charges end up being the same at the beginning, but those individuals end up working out usually some type of deal with a lesser charge. They end up with lesser punishments or a lesser charge at the end via negotiating. I did a plea agreement instead of first degree murder, I pled to manslaughter, and now I'm only facing, you know, 7 to 21 years in prison instead of the rest of my life, right? And so oftentimes prosecutors will do those types of deals, or law enforcement will work with people to get information. They provide that information and they're truthful in that information. Prosecutors often will then, at the time of sentencing, this is years down the road, right, say this person was helpful, instrumental in our case, be leaning on them, judge, and then they're given a lesser sentence in some regard. It doesn't mean they get off, they get out. But in the beginning, they're usually charged with the same thing. It's during the plea negotiation process as the case is going to be going on for the next several years that gets kind of worked out, if that makes sense.
It does. It makes a lot of sense. So just because they were charged with first degree or in the alternative second degree doesn't mean that that's what we will end up seeing. And also, if I understand correctly, what one person ends up being convicted of or pleads to might not be what somebody else pleads to.
That is absolutely right. I mean, there's, when you're talking about first degree murder and that's what's charged, the possibilities are endless of where that goes, right? Because you're charged with the most serious thing. It can go anywhere else from there, and different people can result in different things. Someone may plead to second degree. Someone may plead to just a kidnapping. And I don't know, all those factors come out kind of as time goes on, as these individuals hire attorneys and they work those cases. That's where those things come up, where the results end up being different depending on, again, what's the evidence against them? How strong is the case against them? Did they cooperate? What's their background? Do they have a prior history? All those factors come into a prosecutor's decision to how do we resolve these cases at some point, right?
If it does go to trial, will there be one trial with multiple defendants or separate trials for each defendant?
Great question. So could be both, right? It could be a trial with multiple co-defendants at the same time. So one trial for all of them. It could be each of them gets their own separate trial. Usually a prosecutor will want to do one trial with all the co-defendants. Prosecutor wants to try the case once, call their witnesses once, and have the evidence presented against all of them at once. That's the preference, rather than having to do the trial four different times, is just do it one time, right? For defendants, there's a strategy question there, right? Is it strategic for me to go to trial with all these other people here with me, or should I try to sever my case and get a separate trial from everyone else? And those are decisions that are made in the course of the case. How much evidence is there against my client? Is my client just the client that was filming the fight? I want to sever that guy out from everyone else. He wasn't beating. He wasn't this. He wasn't that. Judge, the only evidence against, alleged evidence against my client is X, Y, and Z. It's very different. It's not even on the same level. So I should get a different trial, right? So then they'll be fighting about getting their own trial. Because ultimately, I think each one would want their own trial, presumably, if they can, right?
So it's just up to the judge.
It is. It's up to the lawyers, right? Strategy questions and decisions of do they want to go to trial with everyone or do they want to have their own? You might find some lawyers that say, there's not much evidence against my client. I don't mind going to trial with these other three or four guys because I can sit there in the corner with my client and ask the cop or the witness, What did you find? You didn't find anything against my client, did you? No, you didn't find anything against my client. No. And then he just looks like he's not really involved. And you can keep kind of pointing the finger at these other ones. And my client didn't really do anything, right? That maybe presentation wise, that looks good to be in trial with everyone else potentially. So it's ultimately a strategy question for the attorneys involved on how do they want to pursue that. But you're right. It is the judge's decision is, do they go together? Do they go separate? Depending on what the attorneys are requesting, right?
All of this information is so good. I really appreciate this.
Absolutely.
We all have these questions. All right. So it seems that everyone is being held with a $1 million secured bond. Can you explain what that is?
Sure. Yeah. That's when you start getting in the millions, it's about as high as you go normally. A secured bond means an individual can post that bond through a security. So they could go through a bail bonds company. They can go directly to the court, but a secured bond means an individual post either cash or property with that amount of value. They post it up, they put it up. So for example, in theory, I guess if someone had a $1 million home and they have $1 million in equity in that home, right? It's the equity that matters in that home, not just the home's worth $1 million, but they owe 900,000. It's only 100,000 equity in that home. That's not going to cover it, right? So that there's a security, there's something that the court is holding in their hands to assure this individual is going to show up in the future. If they don't, that surety is lost, that home is lost, or whatever was put up is lost. But it does allow for the possibility of the individuals getting out if that amount is posted.
The whole million? So I always thought you had to come up with like 10%.
Right. Yeah. So there's two different ways to go about it. It gets a little bit confusing whether or not an individual goes through a bonds company or not, but a secured is usually, yes, 10%,
wow,
some security that covers, you know, something else, right?
So they have to come up with $100,000 plus $1 million of value somewhere. Is that what they have to do,
yes,
to get out?
Yeah. So there's a couple different ways. It gets a little bit confusing, but they can go directly to the court and do it that way. If they find a bonds company that's willing to work with them, sometimes a bonds company will say, you just give us the 10%, for example, the 100,000, and we'll come up with the 900,000,
wow,
to cover the difference. But at the end of the case, you're not getting your 100,000 back. It's not being returned to you. That's our cost of doing business, right? So it's a little bit on the business side of things when you're talking about a bond. The part that I think the community should understand is there is the ability for these individuals to post, and there's the ability for these individuals to get out of custody. I've seen $1 million. I've seen more than $1 million. But under the laws in the state of Arizona, individuals are entitled to bonds. That is the law. They can't just,
every single person, every single crime.
They are. There's some rare circumstances where they're not entitled to a bond. If they're already out on a bond on a case and they commit a new offense, mm-hmm, then they don't get a bond on the new crime they've committed. So there are some circumstances where they may not be entitled to that bond. But generally speaking, the law is, the presumption is, you are entitled to a bond. Yes.
Okay. And then I heard that the release conditions would be supervised release, ankle monitoring, no contact with your co-defendants, can't go to the scene of the crime. All of those sound pretty familiar. What does supervised release mean?
Yeah, supervised release means if they post that bond and they get out, they're under the supervision of pretrial services, which is kind of an arm of the probation department of the court. And so they would need to be checking in with an individual routinely. So supervised release could entail things like a curfew. You have a curfew and you must be in at this time. It could be something as extreme as you got to put an ankle monitor on.
Mm-hmm.
It could be, yeah, like you said, you can't go around your co-defendants. You can't talk to them. You need to check in with us. It could be you need to drug test.
Mm-hmm.
If we call you on this particular day, you better go drug test on that day. And if you don't come up as a clean test, your release could be revoked. So you're under supervision. You're not just out, you know, on your own. There's conditions that are put upon you, and those conditions can vary depending on, you know, the judge's discretion. So
ankle monitoring doesn't mean you have to stay home. It means we know where you are, so you can go to work. Is that
correct?
Right?
Correct. Okay. Ankle monitor doesn't mean you're stuck at home. It means you just have a monitor on keep it charged, and we can look up your location at any time. And specifically here in Maricopa County, if you have an ankle monitor, you're restricted to Maricopa County. Generally speaking, in felony cases, you're restricted generally to the state of Arizona. So if you don't have an ankle monitor, you could go up to Sedona or Prescott or Flagstaff if you wanted to freely. But if you have an ankle monitor, you are kind of restricted to Maricopa County. Of course, attorneys, defense attorneys can petition the court to have that removed for special circumstances or for different things. I've had clients who, you know, had a family member pass away out of state. Can they have that removed to fly out of state on this day, return on this day, and gotten permission from the court for certain circumstances? You can do that as well.
Okay. How long do these cases usually take?
Ooh. Yeah, that's the part. That's a great question. It's going to be a long and a slow process. I mean, that's the thing that the community needs to know, that this is not swift justice in any way. I mean, if you think it took a long time to get to here, and I do, it takes even longer to get to the end of this. I mean, usually on general felonies, when I say general, I'm not talking about murder cases. Mm-hmm. Usually at best it's, you know, 6 months, more like a year on the top end. On these types of cases, I would say at best a year. It could be up to two, could be longer, just depends on what happens down the road, but it's going to be a long process, because I am presuming, based on experience, if it took the police and prosecutors this long to put it together, the evidence, and I imagine the hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of people they've interviewed and what they've gone through, it took them that long to get to here to present to a grand jury. That's just them starting the case. Now, the defense attorney, whoever it is who gets assigned or whoever they hire, gets that evidence. It's going to take months and months and months to get that evidence in, and months and months and months to review it and then formulate strategies and different things. So you're talking, yeah, probably a few years before you see some type of resolution. Is it possible it could happen sooner? Absolutely. If an individual came in and met and felt it was in their best interest with the advice of their attorney to resolve their case early, if there was some type of offer being extended to them, they could resolve it much sooner if they chose to. Obviously, this is a very high-profile case. It's garnered a lot of media attention with good reason. And so usually in my experience, those types of cases that are more high profile, that are in the news, they usually don't resolve quickly because there's a lot of pressure there, right? Let's be honest, let's call it what it is. There's a lot of political pressure here going on. There's political pressure for Queen Creek Police. There's political pressure on Gilbert Police. You know, why did this take so long? Why weren't you doing anything? Why didn't you respond to this stuff sooner? Could this have been prevented if police had done their job better, right? There's political pressure on the county attorney's office as well. You know, you had opportunities earlier, you didn't, you waited, now you did this, you know, why? So there's political pressure. And when there's political pressure on politicians, right, there's going to be a certain response. So do I think it's likely they respond quickly or soon? Absolutely not. I think this is going to be a long, drawn out fight. And I think because of the political, I guess, pressure or angles to this, I expect it to just be there for quite some time. Whether or not there's plea offers extended, I don't know. I don't know. I would assume not, considering the high profile nature of what we're dealing with.
I'm glad you mentioned that. I have a question that maybe I shouldn't ask, but I want to ask. People aren't going to like this question. Do you think that this case has been overcharged based on is it a makeup call? Is it a ref who's missed too many things, who's doing a makeup call, or is this normal charging?
Good question. I mean, I've seen it all. I've been in criminal law since 2005. It's been a long time. I've seen it all. I've charged these cases. I've defended these cases. So I've been on both sides of all levels of homicide cases and everything in between. So it doesn't get any more serious than this, right? Is I need to qualify this answer. I need to say first and foremost, like before I'm an attorney, I'm a human being, right? I'm an individual. I'm part of this community, and my heart goes out to Preston's family and all those affected, the victims of these particular crimes. I want to say that I know what I do for a living as a defense attorney, and I defend people. But again, my heart goes out to that. But I've been doing this for a long time. And again, it doesn't get any higher than first degree. I believe if you ask Preston's family, his loved ones, those ones close, they would say, absolutely, this is the right charge. Mm-hmm. If you're asking, you know, people on the other side, is this the right charge? They would say, absolutely not. Mm-hmm. You know, maybe my loved one did do this, but this is just too much, right? That is the decision on what to charge is, that's Miss Mitchell's decision, right? On what charge does she pursue? And that's why she's elected to make those tough decisions. The voters have elected her to be the voice of the people on what is appropriate. She feels like this is appropriate under these circumstances. Again, I'm not excusing one individual killing another individual by any way, shape, or form, but do I think first degree murder is what, and that these people should be in prison the rest of their lives? Personally, I do not.
What I'm really asking is, if there wasn't all this political pressure, is this the charge we would have seen under this set of facts?
My opinion, no.
Based on your experience, no. Based on your 20 years.
No, I don't. I don't think it does. I think this case has gotten a ton of attention because of where it happened, who it happened to, when it happened, and plus all the background of everything going on in Gilbert and what wasn't done, and all the many other assaults that were going on. But this isn't the first time some crime like this has happened. An individual got beat and was beat brutally and died from it. Not that that was ever the person's intention, but this isn't the first time something like this has happened. And I think there is an aspect of pressure to this that to go a little bit more. In my experience, again, I've been doing this a long time on both sides. I'm not just biased from this side. I've done it and seen it from both. When there's eyeballs on a case, things get, you know, more serious, things get charged more, everything is just looked at a little bit closer. And I can't help but think, because of all the pressure on this, you know, something has been ratcheted up. I'm not saying that they don't have the evidence to charge it. That's not what I'm saying, right? Prosecutors have discretion. The county attorney has discretion on what to charge based on evidence. And they can charge the most serious thing, the next most serious, or this, wherever they want. And they have the power to decide that. And I think here they went all the way to the top because of the eyeballs that are on this and what has gone on. I mean, I think when, you know, things were submitted to the county attorney originally some while ago and charges didn't go forward, there was kind of an outcry like, wait, what? It finally got to you and you're not doing anything? That's crazy, right? That doesn't look good.
No.
And I've known Rachel for a long time. I worked there with her for many years. I'm not saying she's corrupt or anything like that. I think she does everything to the best of her ability. I really do. But I can't help but think there is some political pressure involved here. Absolutely.
Okay, Mark, give me 1 second to make sure that I have gotten to everybody's question.
Absolutely.
Since we are live streaming, I just want to make sure we don't not answer anybody's questions. Okay, here's a good one. Do you think the adults who participated in the cover-ups will be accountable for Preston's case? Parents, coaches, staff, etc.
Yeah, that's a great question. It's pretty broad because you're getting into a lot of other aspects, right? We're talking about the criminal law element, the crimes that are charged. Is there liability for others that help cover up? Probably, but there's different types of liability. There's civil liability, right, where someone's being sued for money or damages and things like that on the cover up. But does that rise to the level of criminal? I don't know because I don't know that, right? Again, I just forgot the name, but the woman who came out recently who worked for Mr. Renner, right, and talked about right away they sent him up to Sholo, to the cabin, and they got an attorney involved right away and whatever else. And again, I'm an attorney and I put in my brain, look, hiring an attorney isn't a crime.
Right.
It's not. As a public, do we love it that they went and hired an attorney and zipped it? No, we don't love that as the public, but we're in the United States and that's our constitutional right to do that, is to get an attorney and be quiet. So, that in and of itself doesn't mean the parents should be charged with something because they got their son an attorney. Absolutely, absolutely not. But was evidence destroyed? Those types of things are different questions that I don't have the answers to. But if there is evidence that mom, dad, or others destroyed evidence, destroyed cell phones, did this, did that, yeah, that can be a criminal charge. If an individual, again, I say this with all sensitivity, but if an individual is involved in a crime, presumably, they're not under a legal obligation to go turn themselves in. Hey, look at my knuckles. They're all bloody.
Right.
That's not what society and the law requires us to do. So him, quote unquote, hiding out allegedly, I'll say, or whatever else, till his hands healed or whatever else, it's not a crime.
And it's not destroying evidence. Right. Letting your body heal isn't destroying evidence.
Right. It's not. So, I need to parse that out when we're, the question's a very broad question, so it's kind of hard to answer it totally for your viewers or listeners, but I'm doing the best I can, but there is the potentially, depending on what's there. Yeah. Others can be charged, or school administrators can be, somehow have some type of responsibility to, the community and others and different things, but that's more on the civil side of things versus the criminal side of things. The criminal is, what's the crime? Did you help with the crime? Did you help get away from the crime, meaning drive away or hide evidence? But again, letting your hands heal, staying inside and indoors isn't itself a crime, if that makes sense.
Here's a really good question. With regards to Taylor Sherman, he's the one who allegedly recorded and is also being charged. This question is, does that mean anyone else with a video will be in the same position?
Yeah, great
question.
Will
someone who possesses a video, and I've got people DMing me about their kids having videos of different fights, and they're freaking out.
Right,
so
right.
Tell parents, what's the deal here?
Yeah, no, that's what I was trying to hint at earlier, and maybe I wasn't very clear about it. Having videoed something that happened, some assault that happened, you're not a criminal for doing that. You're not. That's not a crime, possessing a video of this kid beat up that kid or whatever else may have happened. That in and of itself, you're not in the same position as this individual that's charged. The fact that this individual is charged, I have to believe, maybe I'll be proven wrong later, the prosecutor's got to have something else. Simply filming what's going on in and of itself is not enough. You're simply there and you're filming it. You're not doing anything. So if kids are out there and have videos of this or other things, that doesn't make them a criminal. It might make them a witness. They might have evidence to something, but simply having it doesn't make them a criminal or put them on this same level. That's what I'm saying. There's got to be something else for this particular, I say kid, individual involved. Everyone's a kid to me.
Me too.
To this particular individual, there's got to be something else that led them to put him on that same level with someone. Was he part of this plan ahead of time? This is what we're going to go do to this kid. I'm going to film it. You're going to hold him.
Sure.
You're going to beat him. Was there this plan? And he was part of that clear plan beforehand of it. Then it rises a level because now he is soliciting, he's aiding another, he's part of this plan or conspiracy to go do this thing, right? That's different than just, you're there, you're at a party or you're in the street or the party's being broken up and you're walking down and all of a sudden you see a tussle going on and you know you grab your phone and you pull it up and you start filming, that's a completely different scenario. So parents, don't worry if your kids have videos of things going on that teenagers do.
There is an email floating around from the Queen Creek Police Department to one of the alleged suspects who is thought to be the getaway driver.
Okay.
And this email from Queen Creek Police Department that's floating around says, you know, we're not moving forward with you. You won't be charged. This person also allegedly has ties to police. Can you just address that? Because I know people are going to ask.
That is shocking. I mean, it's shocking. But I don't, look, I've been doing this a long time. I've seen all sorts of things. I have seen police do some odd things that don't make sense and seem contrary to things. An email to someone saying, hey, we're not going to charge you, seems weird. I've never really heard that before. Have I heard of or seen or believe cops maybe on the side tell someone, hey, you tell me this and we'll let you go? Absolutely. I think that happens all the time. Is there official things where police say you cooperate with us, and if you do so, we won't charge you? Yeah, we see those all the time. It's an agreement. They sign it. It's like a contract. And if you do this, right, you do this and then we won't charge you. We caught you with some drugs. You help us find some more drug dealers and we won't charge you with your possession of drug crimes or something. Those are agreements. Those are all formal things that are written out, signed. It's an official document, but an email is odd for sure, because it's just kind of a one-sided from, and it's in writing. So it's not very subtle. If it's in an email, that's odd. It's not like a signed contract.
The circumstances apparently were, mom was saying, hey, when am I going to get my kid's phone back? Y'all told me you weren't moving forward and he wasn't involved. And apparently there's an email back that is, you know, been publicly posted saying, yeah, you're right. We know we're not moving forward with that. We'll get you your phone back. We'll let you know. Thanks for your patience. Just bear with us.
But so, yeah, how do we know? Odd. How do they? Yeah, that is odd. That they would say that. But now we think that's the driver,
right? That's the allegation.
Yeah, that is odd. I mean, if that's what's there, I will tell you, the police saying, "Yeah, you're right. We're not doing anything. We'll get back to you in a minute." Can police change their mind? Absolutely, they can
totally.
Change their mind, right? The fact that if they haven't given the phone back yet leads me to believe, like,
right,
like, oh shoot, we sent that out too soon. Maybe we shouldn't have. Always in the back of my mind, I've always thought from the beginning, Queen Creek is, by the way, like a newer police agency.
Right.
It's not that old. I don't remember how long ago it was established, very recently. So talking about a new chief, a new chain of command, you're talking about new people at Queen Creek Police Department. That wasn't around, you know, 10 years ago. This is
right. It's 2 years old.
Right. Yeah. I was going to say, I was going to say two, but I wasn't sure. That's baby. It's infancy. Mm-hmm. It's brand new. So I chuckle internally when I see these things, and I'm like, oh, they're new. They got one of the biggest, most serious cases right off the bat, and they're learning the hard way of what to do and what not to do, obviously. And that's probably a clear example of what not to do is tell someone, you're right, we're not doing anything with your kid, when, you know, again,
it's too early to say that.
Too early to say that. They can change their mind. And that's the thing that people need to understand as well. The county attorney, when they got those alleged, not alleged, when they got the reports from police before to charge them and they didn't, the county attorney doesn't say back to them, we looked at this and we're never charging these people. They don't, that's not what they say. They may have said, and I believe they probably said to them, hey, look, can you get us more evidence? Can you get us more information? We need this or we need that. Or can you get this cell phone or get into that cell phone or go interview this person or that person? Get us, do some more investigation and then bring it back to us. They would never give a hard no, right? Because you don't know, especially in a case like this, who else and what else is going to come forward. So why would you ever talk in absolutes of, you're right, we're not doing anything with your kid, we'll give it right back. Like, it just doesn't make sense that they would do that, other than I would chalk that up to lack of experience or proper conduct. So, but they can absolutely change their mind if evidence comes to light later. This actually might be the driver. Oh, shoot. Let's hang on to this phone. There might be something actually in here. Let's actually hang on to this phone. Let's look at cell phone tower data. Was it in the area? Was it driving out of the area at the specific time? There's all sorts of stuff they can get off of a phone. Mm-hmm. Just like pictures and videos, right?
Mm-hmm. Do the victims get a say in the charges?
No, good question. Victims don't get a say in the charges. However, under Arizona law, under the Arizona Constitution specifically, there's a victim's bill of rights. And so victims don't have a right to say what the charge is. But now that there is charges, I understand there was arrest warrants that were made, right? And so once the case gets started in the court system, victims will have rights to attend court, to speak, to address the court whenever they want and talk to the court. They have the right to talk to the prosecutor and consult with the prosecutor about what they think, what they want, what they believe. Plead this out. Don't plead this out. Don't give them a plea or give them this plea or I'm okay with this. I'm not okay with that. They're allowed to give their input now that the case is in the court system as an alleged victim. That's part of the victim's bill of rights under the Arizona Constitution. So they don't get to say what the charges are, but they do get to participate absolutely in the process via the prosecutor's office and directly to the court now moving forward.
Mark, that is all the questions that we have. If you don't get conflicted out, I am positive that we will have more questions for you. Really, really appreciate you coming on and educating us and answering all of my questions. Really appreciate it.
Absolutely. It was great to participate with you and just let me know if you need any help in the future.
Thank you. I will. And it's great to meet you. Thanks so much for listening to the Modern Divorce Podcast. Remember, anything you've heard today or anything you read online is not the replacement for actual consultation with an attorney and does not create an attorney-client relationship. Even if you called in and we spoke to you, you are anonymous and we don't have your details and you have not become a client of Modern Law. However, we would love to speak with you, or you should seek out the advice of legal counsel or counseling or any other expert near you. And if you have an idea for a show topic or you need to speak with an attorney in Arizona, you can reach me at info@mymodernlaw.com.